morning, everybody. It's about 10 after 9, July 24th, 2008. Probably be August before we're done here. With me today is Senator Huggins, Senator Olson, Senator Elton, Senator Thomas. Today we're going to take up two bills, Senate Bill 402, and then we're going to go to 403. 402 this morning, we'll hear from the administration on the resource rebate proposal. As we all know, we've had a substantial spike in the price of energy, and particularly the concern here is home heating this winter for the residents around the state to help them with this price shock issue that the state's facing with, or the citizens are faced with. And we're going to go to 4003, which is the appropriation of funds for the rebate program. It addresses a few other items related to the energy, governor's energy relief plan. What we're going to do is we're going to walk through 402, and then we'll go on to 4003. With that, I'd like to invite Ms. Randy Roraro is here representing the administration, special assistant, the office of the governor, and we have backup of Ms. Rayfield is here from the Office of Management and Budget, and also Jerry Burnett is in and out. I guess he's still here from Admin Services, Department of Revenue, and I'd like to welcome all three of you to Senate Finance. And Randy's second appearance here, so it's probably going to be numerous over the next calendar year, I would expect. But anyway, that, Mr. Roraro, if you can walk us through this bill and kind of explain what your boss is proposing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Randy Ruaro, R-U-A-R-O. I'm a special assistant to the governor. Chairman Stedman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today on SB 4002, the resource rebate bill. Mr. Chairman, SB 4002 is a very important bill for Alaskans. The bill and the accompanying appropriation would allow the state to share part of its wealth on a special one-time basis, a $1,200 payment with Alaskan residents. There are three, main points about the bill that I see that are strong pros or advantages. First, the bill, the payment principle of the bill is that all Alaskan residents would share equally in the benefit. No Alaskan resident would be left behind regardless of where you live or other factors. That's a principle, Mr. Chairman, that's somewhat unique to Alaska's constitution. In Article 8, the resource article fixes that Alaskans own our resources and resource wealth equally in a public trust type setting. And that was very important when it was adopted into our constitution. Second, Mr. Chairman, the initial payment covering the 80 to 90% of Alaskans, about 620,000, can be done quickly. Our Division of Finance believes it can get checks out to individuals roughly 30 days from now if the bill were to pass. So timing, to the extent that it's important, this proposal allows that to occur quickly, a payment. Finally, Mr. Chairman, this is an important part of the bill that I've worked on with other staff for several weeks, is to include veterans that receive certain types of VA benefits that are reduced by the receipt of outside income. The bill would include payments to those veterans and hold them harmless from any offsets. And that's a very important part of the bill. I've heard from, had phone calls from several veterans who say we don't apply for the PFD because when we receive it, we're not held harmless, and then we end up receiving no benefit from the payment. So that's an important part of this bill. Mr. Chairman, there are some disadvantages, to the bill. One is that the payments are taxable income. That's not disputed. And the, I don't know that you would call it a disadvantage, but in federal law, for general assistance payments, there are many rules that allow the federal government to reduce benefits for Social Security, Medicaid, other items that this bill proposes we would hold those beneficiaries harmless from those federal rules so that they could receive the full benefit of the payment. Mr. Chairman, that's a general overview of the bill. Mr. Burnett is present and could walk through a sectional review if that's the wish.
That would be nice. We can do that with him. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you for Mr. Ruaro. They made a statement that all residents would share, but I guess the question would be, what are we using for a definition of resident? Because if you've been here for 6 months, the way I read it, and I'm not sure that meets residency requirements, but help me on the definition.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, there are actually two pools of people that can qualify as a resident eligible for the payment. The first pool is all persons found eligible by the Department of Revenue to receive a 2008 permanent fund dividend. So we're using the residency definition for the permanent fund dividend in that sense. The second pool, which is much smaller, is persons who have established residency according to some criteria laid out in the bill, lived here the last 6 months, and intend to remain indefinitely and can provide proof of that they've been here. So there's two separate pools. The first pool, people eligible for the 08 PFD, is by far the largest. That's probably 620,000 to 630,000 Alaskans. The second pool we expect would be much smaller, possibly as low as 30,000 to 40,000.
So if I might, Mr. Chairman, so by definition, it appears that we're including non-residents in this program. If I'm wrong, is it non-resident? They're non-residents by our definition?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I guess to distinguish between the two pools, they're not eligible for an 08 PFD, which means they may not have lived here for the entire year of 07, or just chosen not to apply, like some of the veterans who don't benefit from the PFD. So they do have to be, for the second pool, they do have to be residents as defined in the bill, which is have lived here for a six-month period. I think it's April 1st to October of 08, and intend to maintain Alaska as their home. So in that sense, they would be qualified as a resident under that second definition.
Okay, thank
Senator,
you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Barrero, thanks for coming in and clarifying some of the issues. But one of the things you pointed out was the ability for some, or the, I guess, the concern that some people may not be benefiting from this, either on public assistance programs or veterans and those kind of things. What options do they have as far as opting out of that program, or are they automatically getting $1,200 one way or the other if they get a PFD?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, we've included some language in the bill. I think it's subsection 1C that allows an individual to elect to not to receive the payment. And basically, we included that in there because the rules on the federal rules on pulling back or offsetting income, and there's so many different programs. We wanted to give someone flexibility to say, I'm better off electing not to receive this payment than being dropped out of a program because it puts me over an income cap.
Mr. Ruaro, maybe you could help me with the title. It talks about an Alaska resource rebate, which I guess could be defined in several ways. Then the other issue that I had mentioned earlier when we started work on this bill is the need for energy relief to the citizens of the state, in the especially in western Alaska, and there's Interior and Fairbanks where it's cold, and even all the way into southeast where it would appear, due to the hydro, that there'd be no relief needed. But in fact, most of the residents in southeast heat with oil-fired oil-fired boilers. So are we looking at some kind of an energy relief program in disguise? Are we looking at a program when we have swollen coffers at the Treasury to disperse excess Treasury revenue, as some would may perceive it as excess, I certainly don't, to the people directly? What are we dealing with here?
To the chairman, the basis, the foundation of the bill is that toward the end of fiscal year 08 ended with billions of dollars being put into savings, priorities funded, and still a significant amount of revenue left over that I believe will be swept into the CBR. I think it's roughly $740 million. I'm not definitely not an expert on budget issues, but the principle is that spending priorities were met, significant savings were deposited, and it, still there remained a significant amount of funds in FY08 and likely to be a fairly significant amount of surplus in FY09. So the basis, the principle of the bill is a share the wealth resource rebate. There are no restrictions on how the funds can be spent, but certainly if folks, and we think a lot of Alaskans would choose to spend them on energy-related costs or even investments in items that could save or conserve energy, like a perhaps a more efficient heating system like a monitor or a Toyo stove versus a pot-burning oil stove.
I don't know if this next question should go to Ms. Rayfield or Mr. Burnett. For years, the state had struggled with minimal capital budgets and concentrated on meeting our operating obligations and then doing a federal capital match for capital projects. That went on for several years, building up a substantial backlog of deferred maintenance, and then we came into the years of some excess revenue, and we're trying to catch up on some of that stuff and increase our savings. So where's the analysis showing us that we're at the point where the Treasury has sufficient liquidity set aside, where from here going forward we can just concentrate on dispersions from the Treasury and not continue the effort to save and protect the state for future declines in oil prices? And then we have questions from Senator Thomas and Senator Huggins, and then Senator Elton.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
And let me add just one little bit. We've passed a bill at the end of this last session, which some of us view as a cornerstone to a fiscal plan, to help us with that discussion, which this table is looking forward to next winter in the regular session, talking about what kind of savings a state should have set aside in liquid form, because we're getting close to paying off the CBR, Constitutional Budget Reserve, and then coming up with a plan for the future. So is there a sequence issue here, or help the committee with what we're dealing with here?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Karen Rayfield with OMB, and I appreciate the last few days as we've had discussions about the appropriation bills before you and the concern around the table of not having the entire picture. We are committed to producing for you that long-range fiscal plan that was enacted in House Bill 125, and I think at this time the Department of Revenue has, although they have not officially redone the spring forecast, I think it's clear that Alaska is in a position at the moment with the price of oil where it is to see significant revenue coming into the state. I also believe that around this table there's been agreement that we need to put aside as much of those excess revenues as we can into savings while still allowing for those capital needs that have been neglected in the past, and I think we're working together to make that happen. I don't have a picture for you today. I wish I did have one. We are working on that picture. The reason that we're here before you this morning is to talk about because of our revenue situation, it's a blessing to the state of Alaska, and it's also providing significant hardship on Alaskans for the cost of oil. The one-time resource rebate or payment would certainly assist Alaskans in meeting some of those high energy costs while we work on a longer-term solution to reduce the cost of energy for the entire state. So I appreciate the question and the work that we need to do on the long-range fiscal plan, and we're committed to bringing that to you.
Okay, and we're going to go here to Senator Thomas, and then we'll go down the queue of questions. I guess the concern is, in a special session, one issue is dealing with the energy crisis across the state and making sure that people can heat their homes this winter. It's a whole other issue to disperse excess, what some may appear to be excess savings, which we haven't even defined yet, from the Treasury, so I have some concerns with that. But Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. Along the same lines, what it started out as an energy rebate, which I thought was a great idea, and then for some reason, and then that's part of what I'd like to know, that there was a change in terminology, if not philosophy, but it appears mostly terminology to call it something different. But as I look at the requirements, I'm concerned that even if we call it something different, my concern is that people could collect this that are present in the state simply during the summer months, although it doesn't say intends to maintain a home, but that's something that would cause a lot of legal problems, I guess, if we got into that. So I'm wondering why we did not simply use the permanent fund list of recipients and go forward with that rather than creating now another situation with quite a few criteria here that all very much in line with somebody having to have been a resident anyhow and received a permanent fund. So the more I read it, the less I see a great deal of difference in someone here, other than I do see that the shorter time frame, the more recent time frame, I guess, for somebody being able to collect it, is somebody that has never even paid a heating bill. And I realize we're not calling it a energy rebate any longer, we're calling it a resource rebate, but it's just curious to me. So if you could kind of maybe answer those questions and assure me that this is a good idea to call it something different and not just address it head on as we initially started out.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, I'll start with, I think the first question was, has there been a change from a energy relief approach to now a broader resource rebate approach? And I went back and looked at some of the documents, and the principle of the basis of the bill of sharing some wealth with the citizens has always been present. What was different in earlier efforts, I guess, was to try to narrow the focus of the use of the benefit to energy only expenses. And what we found when we looked at the debit card, when we did a very detailed analysis, was that there are many, let me back up, a debit card approach would have worked for a large percentage of the population, as much as 80-90%, but it didn't work for a large number of communities that don't have vendors that could take a debit card. So that's why we made a change there. We didn't want to and the costs of the program to administer, but that's why we moved away from that approach. There were too many communities that where citizens just couldn't use a debit card, mostly in rural Alaska. The other approach that had been talked about was a payment to utilities and rate reductions, and we retained expert outside counsel, and they found that there were some tax issues on probably a few different levels, and rather than take that approach, we moved to the approach that's before you. But the principle, the underlying principle, has been consistent, which is share the wealth of the state. So the sideboards, I guess, have fallen away, but the underlying principles remain the same. And then to your question about could we just use the PFD list and not have a supplemental process, that actually reflects an amendment that was adopted in House CNRA yesterday, and we're not opposed to that approach. And I'd like, with the chair's permission, to work with the committee staff over the next couple days to review that. And then I think finally, why did we put in a supplemental process? We were mainly concerned about picking up the group of veterans who were calling and saying, you know, if you just go with a PFD list, I don't apply because my benefits are offset. So I get no gain, you know, from applying for a PFD. And they were requesting to be included somehow in this payment. And that's mainly why we wanted a supplemental process. We wanted to pick up those veterans, and they are, disabled. I think it's non-service disabled veterans and veterans over 65 who have an annual income, I think, of less than $13,000. So we wanted to somehow get them the benefit of the payment.
Just a short follow-up. I certainly don't disagree with that. The unfortunate part about it is people now view it as an energy relief. That's what it is. And all the discussion has been that the high prices, and when we change the theory, you can't change the thought in people's mind, and it's the inequity that I think people are concerned about. It's this, the concept of giving, if you had said we're going to do another permanent fund, or we're going to increase or supplement the permanent fund, would have been wise to have said that to begin with, because now people have all looked at their energy bills, and they considered the energy card, they considered those things, and all the discussion is about, boy, is it fair? And I tell people every day, nothing is going to be exactly fair, there's no doubt about it, but when somebody believes that it was energy relief, and now there's a change in the name, and there's a family of three versus a family of eight, there's no way that the energy consumed is eight times more in a home at all. And it had this huge argument out there, which has made it very difficult for people. Maybe it's fortunate we've been down here so much that we haven't had to sit and deal with it directly. But, you know, we had a town hall meeting, and the whole discussion was not about an extra permanent fund or supplementing the permanent fund. It was the fairness of the situation based on consumption in different parts of the state, as well as the temperature in different parts of the state, and the costs of energy in different parts of the state. And you're never going to quell that concern that exists. And frankly, I agree with them. And now everybody is stuck with that. This is not fair. And everybody in the state, including those that have basically had no energy increase. So, you know, I'm not quite sure how to state it, but it makes it very difficult for me to explain to people, oh, well, now it's a different deal. You know, it's not energy relief anymore. It's simply a distribution of the resource wealth that we have on an individual basis, yet at the same time, we're talking about long-term, mid-term, and long-term solutions to the energy problem. So the energy keeps entering into it continually anyhow. So I'm not sure what to tell you. It's more or less a comment as to what I see and hear on a daily basis and the emails I get on a daily basis. Nobody's talking about any kind of resource or supplement to the permanent fund.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Thomas hit on the head of the nail my concern in looking at where we've been and then where we're going. And so I'll just make a couple of comments and ask a question. Number one, I would highly recommend that people that are working on this concept and concepts of programs in the future not use the technique of probing or researching by media releases and then get feedback, and then here we are in the second iteration of the program, for all the reasons that if a council was able to find that there are difficulties with a utilities buy-down program, he can find out that same issue before you do the media release, and we don't have to go through that iteration. That's just, I'm just giving you a little feedback, because for the same reason that Senator Thomas had his town hall meetings and he's getting feedback and expectations being created, it's being called something, and we got a new title and a new expectation, and people are getting confused. And I, quite frankly, have heard the same thing from some of my constituents. My question for you, though, is who is working on this program? Who is the head of the snake, and who are the people that going down to the tail of the snake, so that as this thing continues to work, when we talk to people, we know that they're working on this?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, who in the administration is working on the program, is that?
Correct.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, it's myself, Mr. Burnett, Ms. Rehfeld, representatives from Health and Human Services on the hold harmless provisions, employees of the Division of Finance, who would be the entity that would deliver the checks. There's a number of us that work together on it.
Are there any energy people per se that are working on it?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, Mr. Steve Hagenson has been involved in the discussions for weeks.
Yeah, and I would just say to you, to the extent possible, if we can start including in that circle of flow of information some legislative kinds of people, it would probably help all of us substantially. Mm-hmm. So with that, thank you.
Senator Elman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I've got a couple of technical questions. Mm-hmm. And then kind of an umbrella question, so if you need to move on,
no,
always come
no.
back to me. Mr. Raro, I'm looking at page 3, line 3, beginning on, no, line 1. And it says the person is eligible if they were voluntarily and physically present in the state on the date the individual applied for a resource rebate under this program. Does that exclude people who are in Alaska under military orders? I would not classify that as voluntary.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, the intent was to include provisions apply to the supplemental process. If you're military and you've qualified for the PFD, you're in automatic. For the supplemental process, the intent would be to allow military people who are eligible to qualify as being voluntarily and physically present in the state, even if their orders are that they're overseas or serving. We definitely don't want to exclude military personnel. We want to include them. The language is ambiguous, and we have worked on an amendment in House CNRA that we believe clears it up.
Thank you. And then, Mr. Chair, on page 5, line 14, I think one of the fundamental principles for me, and this perhaps comes from my service, on the Borough Assembly, but on page 5, line 14, it seems to me that what this bill does is it establishes a mandate that gets directly to local control. And it also seems to extend it not just to subdivisions of the state, political subdivisions of the state, but also to Native organizations and tells them what they can or can't do. And I guess I'm interested in why we have done that.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, if Ms. Crayley from the Department of Law could answer that question.
If you could please introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, and then answer the Senator's question.
Yes. For the record, my name is Stacey Crayley. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. And through the Chair, Senator Elton, the purpose of subparagraph O on page 5, which you referenced, was to address concerns or potential issues that arise through the hold harmless provisions of this bill. And let's see if I can explain this. Simply, the hold harmless provisions that are included within the bill address public assistance benefits and the veterans benefits that Mr. Raro mentioned earlier. What we were concerned about, or what we were trying to avoid, was the existence or the development of new programs where municipalities or other organizations could generate a needs-based program which would then be eligible for the hold harmless provision. So what we were attempting to do in this paragraph was to keep the hold harmless limited to those programs that exist at the time that this bill is enacted and not where they could come in and backfill with hold harmless money for future programs.
Mr. Chair, I guess philosophically, I firmly believe that perhaps those are decisions that are best made by local officials at the local level working directly with their residents. And so philosophically, this is a stumbling block for me.
Through the Chair, Senator Elton, we don't disagree that the municipalities and the organizations can create any sort of programs that they think are beneficial for their citizens. What we were trying to do was avoid the ability of those organizations to create a future program and then make it retroactive to apply the hold harmless provisions. So it was more of a chicken and an egg kind of an argument where we wanted to ensure that municipalities and tribal organizations who create new needs-based programs can't then say, oh, we have a needs-based program, and this bill would then allow would require the state to hold that program harmless when it doesn't exist at the time of the creation of this program.
If I could follow up, Mr. Chair. I mean, the premise of this bill, as I've heard it articulated before by members of the administration, is that this is not an ongoing program. And so it would seem to me that if that is the premise, that this is not an ongoing program, that the need, if the payment goes out in September, as Mr. Raro has expressed hope that it could do, it just seems to me that if you aren't anticipating a continuing program, that this that kind of language would therefore be unnecessary.
Through the Chair, Senator Elton, and it may be unnecessary in the context of which you're submitting your question. However, we were trying to avoid the potential of having a number of local-run programs come back and ask to be held harmless for the provision of those programs. It was a stopgap measure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now the umbrella
sure.
question.
Broader question, go ahead.
I mean, one of the, I'm going to make an assumption here that I hope is correct, that this bill was put together with an awful lot of thought. And if it was put together with an awful lot of thought, I'm going to assume that you did some risk assessment kinds of work. And one of the things that I'm extremely concerned about is that by creating a program like this that is a redistribution of resource wealth, as it has been described by Mr. Raro, that a potential risk is that it could have unintended consequences. As my mother would say, if you jerk on the shorts on one end of the clothesline, the clothes up and down the clothesline bounce up and down. And I'm concerned that this could have consequences in Washington, D.C., where congressmen from Newark, congressmen from San Francisco, congressmen from Atlanta, Georgia, congressmen from Detroit, Michigan, are all saying, or could say, that, well, look at this. Alaska is getting rich off their energy resources that we're paying so much for, and that one of the consequences of adopting a program like this would be to create a certain amount of resentment that could spill over onto programs that are extremely important to the state of Alaska. And I'll use an example of the Denali Commission, which is, I think without a doubt, one of those services from the federal government that has assisted the state, especially people in rural parts of the state, to a great degree over a long period of time. And so I'm wondering if there was some kind of a risk assessment by the administration, whether or not you talked to John Katz, whether or not you talked to the congressional delegation, about the potential backlash that could occur, that could affect other programs that are so important to the state.
Through the Chair, Senator Elton, my understanding, and I wasn't in on the conversations, but my understanding is that the senior senator, Senator Stevens, felt exactly the opposite, that members of Congress would be more likely to say that's good that Alaska is helping its residents rather than coming to D.C. and looking for federal funds. They're using their state money to help them through a difficult time, and that he supported the governor's proposal. At the same time, I couldn't guarantee that a senator or a congressman from some other state wouldn't feel the way that you mentioned, that it's you know, why are we providing so much federal funds if the state has enough to pay its citizens this resource rebate. But I suppose in the end, I would follow Senator Stevens' approval of the program and his thought that senators and congressmen would view it as Alaskans helping themselves.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
So I have terms where Ted Stevens is in favor of this 4,000
bill? Through the chair, Senator Olson, I wouldn't want to pretend to speak for Senator Stevens as if I've spoken to him personally or to that extent, but his comments, I think it was a July 2nd press conference with the governor, where that he supported the proposals.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think we have Mr. Burnett. He scurried forward, so.
I was just going to be here for a technical question.
So the ice was getting a little thin. So.
But this is Jerry Burnett, Department of Revenue. I did speak to Senator Stevens' State Director Jim Egan about this program. And he called about it, and he indicated that the senator was quite supportive of it.
We could clarify that. I think the senator's concerned on energy issues in the state and the winter, and a few things. The permanent fund. My understanding of the dividend of the permanent fund is to share the resource wealth to individuals around the state, and we pay royalty monies in there and keep a lot of the earnings in their realized earnings, and the legislature has been very protective of the permanent fund since its creation. And it pays a dividend which now is increasing due to better markets since the first couple of years of the turn of the century. Could you just, is there a philosophical change coming from the administration on the permanent fund, or is the permanent fund still there as the tool for resource wealth distribution and sharing around the state?
Through the chair, I'll field that one. My knowledge, there's no change or shift, just a view that under these current circumstances at this specific time, that there's it's appropriate to make a special one-time additional distribution of the state's wealth.
Other questions? Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to that extent, as I recall, there's $620,000 that would be permanent fund recipients, and then another $30,000 or $40,000. Is there any reason that we could not include the additional check in a same envelope that people get their permanent fund dividend in, and that we may do a mailer to the other $30,000 or $40,000?
The chair, Senator Huggins, it's a matter of timing more than anything else. With including it, we could include it in the amount when we pay permanent fund dividends and just do single check rather than sending a second check and identify on the. And we do direct deposit, so with direct deposit with permanent funds, it is a technically feasible issue. I think the intent of doing this was to be able to do an early distribution so that we could do a distribution in August or first part of, so people would have it by the first part of September, so that people who are paying their, you know, expenses at this time of the year would have that money, or permanent fund dividends go out starting October 2nd.
Senator Huggins?
And that to accomplish that intent, what's the cost factor to the state?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, the cost of sending out the check, it's mostly postage, actually, and it's approximately $500,000.
Yes, I hear you on mostly postage, but a lot of things when we the state do things, we do a chargeback to people because the employee is doing something that's outside the norm. So I'm not so sure that just normal postage is the right answer. If we're consistent in how we apply the state workforce chargeback.
To the chair, to Senator Huggins, we've budgeted the full amount, and there's about $325,000 budgeted for the supplemental application process and the processing, and there's about $500,000 for the checks. And that is, it's computer services, it's printing, it's check stock or warrant stock, envelopes, et cetera. But it is fully out, we fully allocated costs in this for the purpose of the fiscal note in the normal manner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I got a question, then we'll go to Senator Thomas and then Senator Elton. What I'm hearing through the discussion, this is an energy relief. It's a resource rebate. And the permanent fund, you have to be here a year to put some time in Alaska. Some folks around the state would like to have it a little higher than a year, but the court is taking care of that issue for us. Now we have a proposal in front of us for 6 months. So if we're going to have a resource rebate as citizens of the state, why should we share the resource rebate with somebody that just showed up 7 months ago?
To the chair, Senator Stedman, again, the main reason we added a supplemental application process was we knew there were longtime Alaskans, particularly the veterans group, that weren't applying for the PFD. So we needed a way to allow them to qualify, and there may be other Alaskans that just don't apply for the PFD for whatever reason, but we knew we had a pool of disabled and elderly veterans that didn't apply because they don't get the benefit of it. So we were looking for a mechanism, but for the committee's knowledge, there was an amendment adopted in House CNRA that I think greatly narrows the supplemental.
We're going to stay out of the other body.
Okay.
They can do what they do, and we'll do what we do. But, and you're certainly free to offer amendments as a bill sponsor and come talk to my office or another member of the committee to put an amendment on the table. I mean, you know the,
sure.
You know the process. Is the residency requirement 6 months or is it a year?
To the chairman, the residency requirement for the second pool of persons, that is those persons who are not eligible or found eligible for an 08 PFD, the residency period is 6 months as drafted in the bill.
So we can, somebody moved state 7 months, you know, 8 months, they would qualify for this program.
To the chair, that's correct. If they met the requirements, including an intent to remain indefinitely as an Alaskan resident.
Okay, thank you. I think it was Senator Thomas and Senator Elton and then Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Was there some legal reasoning considered to change this at all from a energy assistance type theory to a resource rebate? I know there was some difficulty with, at least I'd heard, that the concept of paying utilities like Golden Valley and other utilities like that directly, if they were co-ops, there was a tax issue or something with the co-op themselves in particular. So if you could respond to that a little bit. And then there must have been some difference consideration for the qualifications, or else it would have just been assumed that we'll just use the permanent fund list and qualifications and dispense with all this new list of things. And I've read many times over and over here, and I'm still questioning this. Page 2, line 25, is not ineligible, that phrase, if you could explain the, how that phrase came about, as well as the concept of if there was any legal concerns of the directly making things reliant onto your energy costs directly as far as your fuel oil bills and electric payments.
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Thomas, foundation for a payment has always, I think, consistently been a sharing of the wealth. It's the sideboards of funneling the money only for energy purposes that we discovered some difficulties with. In the proposal for payments to utilities, outside retained counsel had some concerns about tax issues, and one of those was co-ops are exempt under federal law if 85% or more, I believe, of their income derives solely from membership payments. And there was a concern that providing an outside source of revenue to a co-op could push them beneath the 85% level.
Process. Were you up there, Senator Thomas, who was throwing the question on the table?
Yes, I believe so, but I'm not sure yet.
Okay. Mr. Ferraro, looks like you're anxious to answer a question.
Through the chair, I think I kept track of the Senator Thomas's question, so I can pick up where we left off, if that would be okay. Through the chair, Senator Thomas, on the tax issues, you mentioned co-ops. And we did retain outside counsel, and they did mention that that was a concern we should be aware of, that there wasn't any clear precedent on the issue, but that it was possible that an outside source of income could count against their ratios such that they could lose their tax-exempt status. So that was a concern. On your, I think it's your third question on the legal boundaries of the supplemental process. We selected 6 months because we wanted to clearly stay within the legal boundaries of a residency period. And we are, law has advised that we, with 6 months, we are clearly within the boundary. And so that should help us avoid any legal issues. I think Mr. Burnett can answer your question on page 2, line 25.
To the chair, Senator Thomas, the language D is not ineligible for a permanent fund dividend for 2008 under AS 4323005D. That is the section that provides that incarcerated felons and multiple misdemeanors are not eligible for a permanent fund dividend. So that's what that provision is, so that we don't pay the resource rebate to those people who have denied a PFD because of the incarceration, even under the supplemental process.
Do you follow up, Senator? Yes.
That's good. So it's specific just to that area, because if I read it, I'd want to say, well, not ineligible means that they must be eligible other than for that fact, is what you're saying.
Correct.
Did you look into, in regards to the cooperatives receiving revenue, was it looked at the concept which others have brought up of reducing the cost to the cooperatives or to the electrical suppliers, whether it's through an adjustment or the state paying directly the fuel costs, natural gas or diesel to the cooperatives, versus the idea that they were actually bills paid on individuals' behalf, that it lowered the level for everybody by the costs from the suppliers of natural gas or diesel fuel to electrical cooperatives or electrical suppliers regardless. So it was a cross-the-board situation, that cost going down, being reduced, which obviously would then take the surcharges, as is in Golden Valley's bill, on diesel fuel.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, I don't recall looking at the specific mechanism that you described.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Okay, Senator Elton, and I think it's Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this may require the assistance of Ms. Crailey from the Department of Law, because I want to revisit the issue that we talked about previously on line 14 and page 5. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I'm reading this again in the context of the answer that you provided earlier, that you want to prevent municipalities from doing something. But on rereading this paragraph, it doesn't prevent a municipality from doing something in the future. It only affects what they have done in the past. Because the language is very specific. It says a program that is established before the effective date of this act. It doesn't speak to a program that is implemented before the effective or after the effective date of the act. It's only things that have happened, not things that may happen. Am I misreading this paragraph at all?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, no, you're not. In terms of the public assistance benefit arena, what is considered resource or income for purposes of eligibility is wide-ranging. For purposes of food stamps, it's maybe calculated in one fashion, versus for Medicaid, it's calculated in a different fashion. For senior benefits, it's calculated for a different fashion. So what we were trying to do was to limit the ability to use this as income for purposes of eligibility. So it ties into the hold harmless argument that I was explaining to you earlier, but what it does is it limits the ability of programs to calculate this as income, which would then render individuals ineligible for certain programs.
Mr. Chair, I mean, I had understood that this was to, why would we limit something, why would we void something they've already done, but not prevent them from doing it after the passage of the act?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, it may be inartfully written, but the intent was to address the issue of hold harmless. And so if you, however a program wants to establish their criteria, what we were trying to do was to guarantee that if an individual received this $1,200 resource rebate, it would not affect their eligibility for that needs-based program, whatever it would be. In addition, what it does is it addresses the hold harmless provisions in the other paragraphs in this bill to ensure that programs that are developed after the effective date of this aren't held harmless from, because we don't know what those programs would be. It would be speculative to consider what those would be. Keeps everybody held harmless for what's currently existing, and then also doesn't affect or doesn't allow these needs-based programs to count this resource rebate as income or resources for determining eligibility for a public benefit, for a needs-based benefit.
Mr. Chair, I tend to agree. I think it is inartfully written, and I think it probably needs some review from the administration and perhaps further review by the committee. The second question is, and thanks for the clarification, the second question. Totally different question is, currently in statute, there is a provision that prevents the picture of the governor from being used on a permanent fund dividend check. And I wonder if in the wisdom of that, the past legislature that did that, whether or not the administration would be amenable to an addition to this bill that would prevent the picture of the governor from being used on these checks.
Chair, Senator Allen, I don't think that would be a problem.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, Ms. Crayley launched off. I have a question for her.
I saw her clear out pretty quick.
Good try, Stacy.
Okay. Then Senator. Right, I'll try again later.
Yeah, it's a broader question on the legality. As I recall, Mr. Zobel once upon a time challenged the permanent fund provisions. And my question for Ms. Crayley, though, is that what sort of legal challenge do we see potentially in the future? What's our profile going forward?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, and I don't mean to avoid the question while sitting at the chair, but I don't represent the Department of Revenue and I don't deal with the permanent fund program, so I'm not familiar with the legal analysis that has gone into relative to the risk analysis, the legal risk analysis as to what may or may not be issues with this particular bill. Another assistant attorney general has been working on that closely, and I think he's in another committee hearing right now. So I will take that question back to him, Chris Pogue, and have him get back with you on that. But I'm here as a to provide answers and questions on hold harmless and public assistance benefits.
Good. Yeah, I think it is important for us to hear that, and I apologize for you having to march back up here.
No
after.
Problem.
Well, you can have him get back to my aide also, so we make sure we dispense the information throughout the committee.
Yes.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, and just to follow up on the veterans provision, I guess my first question was, what is the size of the pool of people that do not apply for the permanent fund because they're concerned of impacting their VA benefits?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, to date we've identified a pool of roughly 400 veterans who receive VA benefits that are subject to either a eligibility decision based on income or a reduction, a set off to the amount that the veteran receives. It appears that most veteran or a large number of veterans benefits are based on extent of an injury or some other criteria that's not income affected. But we have found so far, and we're still continuing to work through it with the VA in DC, we've identified about 400 veterans, spouses of veterans, and dependents whose benefits are impacted by the receipt of income.
And then, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then a follow-up on that: what are the provisions that allows that causes the veterans not to be able or do not want to, and they realize the impact for applying for a permanent fund, but for this rebate to be different? How are the two handled differently?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, the rules or statutes that cause the reduction or loss of VA benefits to Alaska veterans are federal statutes and regs, and the way they're handled differently is that in the PFD provisions there is not the hold harmless provisions don't extend to these veterans. In our bill, I think it's section 1P, we do extend the hold harmless provisions to those same veterans. So because they're excluded from the PFD hold harmless, their benefits are affected or reduced. Because we have included section 1P in this bill, they would actually get the benefit of the $1,200 rebate and not have their benefits reduced. And the way what would occur is that the reduction would still occur because federal law requires it, but the state would step in, pay the difference or the amount of the reduction, and then pay the $1,200, so they would receive full benefit.
And I'll save the PFD question till later. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm not sure who to give this question to, but as you look at the permanent fund dividend and some of the people that get it and some of the people that have it taken away from them for child support reason or court settlement or court judgments, are these this $1,200, is that going to be something that can be garnished because of some?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I'll let Mr. Burnett, I think, is most qualified on that question.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, as written, this bill provides that this payment is not will not be garnished for any purpose prior to payment,
including child support,
court judgments, state debt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And if I could, the reason that was done is because of administrative efficiency. We wanted to, this is a separate individual program. We wanted to keep the cost down. Researching it further after discussion, it would not be impossible to do this administratively with child support and other state debt that is done electronically. It wouldn't prevent the timing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
When we look at our telephone banks, most of us in the legislature have a majority of our calls coming in dealing with the permanent fund. It's a rather sensitive issue around the state, particularly if you don't get the dividend. And has there been much thought into the workload dealing with appeals and inquiries on this proposal that will come into the legislature, and how does the administration plan on addressing, helping the elected officials address those issues, because they go, again, back, as you know, Mr. Burnett, to the Department of Revenue, and I think that department dealing with permanent fund dividends get rather busy.
Senator Stedman, I'm very aware of your concern here, but as soon as this proposal began to be discussed, our permanent fund dividend division actually started staffing up with their seasonal people to make sure that we could answer phone calls, because we already have experienced some increase. We would expect any time eligibility becomes more valuable that you will be getting additional appeals, and whether those appeals are the cost of those appeals is allocated to this program or to the regular PFD program is something that we'll have to work on over time. We have included money in the fiscal note to deal with some of that, and would have extra staffing on for that purpose throughout the full year if this bill were to pass.
Okay. And then just kind of a macro philosophical question. A couple years ago, we spent quite a bit of time dealing with oil taxation, and we collectively went from a tax and royalty system to a profit sharing or production sharing contract along with our base royalties, which, as we all know, has in this last year, especially in the last couple of months, a portion of that progressivity issue, a portion of that tax, equal the amount of the base tax or maybe a little more, push the marginal tax rate in the oil industry into the 80s or 90s, to pick your company, substantially high marginal rate, which is good for the treasury of the state. How do you, or help me reconcile this substantial tax burden increase on the industry? Two avenues. One of them is taking the revenue and buying or helping the state build roads and airports, and maybe it's hospitals, whatever we're doing for the infrastructure of the state, building schools, educating our children, making the work environment more conducive to more production on the North Slope by increasing our transportation system, so on and so forth, through the state appropriation process, versus increasing a tax burden on industry and just distributing a check to each individual around the state. Help me with that philosophical difference, and what direction are we going in?
Mr. Chairman, if I I don't disagree with, I think, your premise here. One of it is going to be, of course, of the balance, achieving that balance with the additional revenue that we have to be able to address some of those infrastructure, schools, roads, highways, for our economic future, while putting away funds into savings, which this body did in this last legislative session. You know, we have the opportunity here to do many things that will help us in the future while also providing the resources that we'll need as oil production declines. So I think that our philosophy is not dissimilar. I think that's where we are all trying to go.
Fair enough. Do we have any other questions? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess we talked about the co-ops a little bit, but did not really get to a concept of whether there was a strong legal reasoning for changing from energy relief to resource rebate based on a legal question, legal issues, or whether it was more getting from the concept to the reality of a fair distribution being more the question, which seems to still be the question in most people's minds. So if you could comment on that, and then secondarily, on page 3, and this one has bothered me even with the permanent fund, so maybe that's a question for another day, but it's certainly one for today as we're looking right at it. Line 5 intends to maintain a home in the state. And what's the old saying? The road to hell is paved with good intention. So that one concerns me a bit as far as still using that or continuing to use it with the idea that you either maintain a home in the state of Alaska or you don't maintain a home. And if you sold a home and you left and you want to claim that you're going to still come back and maintain it. And a third issue is the idea of conservation. It seems that if you're just simply paying bills, and I'm a proponent of that. Don't get me wrong. I'm a proponent of paying natural gas and fuel and other fuel source bills directly to distributors, save kind of somewhat the middleman and make sure that you're impacting the problem. But if you are in some cases overpaying actually what somebody expended for energy, and again here we get back into the debate over energy relief versus resource rebates, you are not making much of an impact or helping people understand that there is a problem and we should be looking at conserving if you're going to actually, in some cases, with the $1,200 per individual in a household in some areas where, as I said before, there's been no impact at all to their energy costs other than potentially them driving their car back and forth to work, which is a very very different situation, I see, from the actual consumption and weather conditions that exist in places where you're consuming thousands of gallons of fuel oil.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, I think the first question is that an answer to that is that consistent through the last several months is the theme that the basis for the payment is a sharing of state resources and wealth with the citizens. The what's, I guess, fallen off is the restrictions that funding only be used for energy purposes, and we found that difficult with the debit card because there were vendors in rural areas that, or there weren't vendors in rural areas that could process the card, and we didn't want to leave those citizens, you know, out of the program. For the other approach, outside counsel opined that there were, you know, some tax issues we needed to be aware of, and as a policy matter, we chose not to take the chance that those would arise. That doesn't mean, I guess, that people can't use the payment for energy-related issues, and that could range from paying a bill, an electric bill, or it could range to purchasing a more efficient heating system so that conserved or used a significant less amount of fuel. So there's no restriction on how the funds can be used, but we certainly expect many Alaskans will use the funds for energy-related purposes as their choice. And that choice could range from paying an electric bill, to buying a more fuel-efficient heating system that provides benefits for years and conserves energy. So it's not impossible to use the funds for a long-term conservation purpose. And finally, I think you're correct that on page 3, line 5, it's not well drafted, and it could probably be reworked to make it clear that the person has to maintain a residency in the state as opposed to a home. I suppose there's people that have more than one home in another state and one here. So we'll work on that with the drafters.
And one just short comment. There already are programs that pay directly, particularly in rural areas, pay for heat and other things such as that. So I think that could have been merged with that. But that's a whole different discussion, getting back to energy relief versus just resource rebates. Thank you.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah,
wrap up this bill here.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the same on line 3, but going down, or correction, page 3, line 27 and 28. It appears that the issue, and we're giving money to non-residents of the country. Is that an accurate assessment?
To the chair, Senator Huggins, under the permanent fund dividend program and under this program, there are people who are not citizens of the United States who receive the benefit. They are Alaska residents under the statute, and they're not citizens of the United States, and they do receive permanent fund dividends and other state benefits.
Yeah, but in this case, a person that moved from, you name the country, 6 months ago, or quite frankly, could be a student, will receive this benefit.
To the chair, Senator Huggins, that's correct. The same as under the permanent fund statutes and other state statutes, where people who are residents of the state for that program but not U.S. citizens can receive a benefit.
Yeah, no, I understand. And then my secondary question is, have you done any polling on the popularity of this program?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, none that I'm aware of.
Okay. Would you check, see if you've done any polling on it? I'd be interested in that. And finally, Mr. Chairman, how we arrived at $1,200. Why didn't $15,000 or $2,000 or $2,500 or $500? I mean, tell me the internal debate, since I wasn't there, in the conversation that we winnowed it down to $1,200.
And then maybe in that question, wrap up in the context, there was a couple of bills in the regular session that were going to disperse cash proceeds to the populace that this committee took no action on. And did that factor into the discussion?
Mr. Chairman, to Senator Huggins' question about the $100, why the $100? I believe, and I did not participate in the early discussions on the debit card, but I believe when the team was discussing the possibility of doing a debit card, that $100 a month to Alaskans for things such as paying their gas bill, their heating oil bill, their fuel bills, that would be, provide a significant amount of direct payment to individuals to help with those increased costs, totaling $1,200 for an entire year. When the debit card was determined to be a difficult and expensive approach and it would not serve all Alaskans, we retained that same dollar amount in the proposal that's before you today. And Mr. Chairman, I can't really speak to the bills that were before you in the regular session. I don't know if Mr. Ruaro can, but I don't believe it was an administration bill that you're referring to.
That is correct.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. With that, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside for later review, and we'll go on to the next bill. The next bill and the final bill for today is 4003. We have the same participants here were enthusiastically ready to present this portion, which is interconnected to the previous bill. And if you could walk us through this bill, it should be a little shorter, I think, to work on because of the interrelationship. But if you could walk us through, please. And maybe start by identifying yourself for the record again, just in case they break the tape and just want to start this bill. So everybody's identified.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Karen Rayfeld with OMB, and I'm here this morning to talk to you about Senate Bill 4003, which is the appropriation bill for 4002, which we've just discussed this morning. We may have already covered some of these points, but if you just, I will try to do a brief summary of the bill, and then we can go into some questions if that's your preference. The bill, the appropriation bill, totals nearly $821 million. $800 million of the bill is for the one-time payment to eligible individuals throughout Alaska for the resource rebate program. It does include the associated administrative costs that Mr. Burnett, who is here with me, can speak to for making these payments. There is also $10.7 million included in the bill related to the hold harmless provisions for individuals to protect them from losing their public assistance payments or veterans benefits as a result of this one-time payment. We have also included a request in the bill of some $9.6 million for the power cost equalization program. $600,000 of that is identified as necessary to fully fund the FY08 appropriation and costs for PCE, so that there would not be any proration required. And then the Alaska Energy Authority has estimated a potential $9 million shortfall in the PCE program for 09, which we just approved for the fiscal year starting July 1, based on their estimate of the increase in fuel costs across the state and what those rate increases might look like as we get further into the fiscal year. And finally, Mr. Chairman, there is an estimated $150,000 requested to hold harmless municipalities who have municipal-owned airports that would not receive their shared taxes if the suspension of the motor fuel tax, which we discussed yesterday in Senate Bill 4004, is approved. So those are the components in the bill. I can go through it section by section if that's your preference, or we can just go to questions.
We can just, I think we'll just go to questions on it because they're interrelated and we've taken up much of this subject matter in the last 2 days. We have Senator Elton, and then did Senator Huggins have a question also?
Yes.
And then we'll go to Elton and Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for your patience with some of the questions. I need to have some clarification, I guess, on the interplay between this appropriation bill and the bill we just talked about. In SB 4002, Section 1 provides that subject to appropriation and availability of funds for the program, individuals eligible for the program may receive a payment in the amount of $1,200. In this bill, SB 4003, on page to line 22, it says the sum necessary, estimated to be at $800 million. I mean, in the first bill, I get the impression that there will be a pro rata amount available to individuals. In the second bill, it seems rather clear that it's the sum necessary. So I guess I need to know which is primary. Is the $800 million primary, or is the $1,200 dollar payment primary?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, as written with the appropriation bill and the bill, the 4002 together, the $1,200 would be the amount that would go to everyone as the appropriation is written in 4003. Now, should the legislature choose to appropriate an amount different than the $800 million, so it was a set amount, say whatever amount, then it would be prorated to an amount less than $1,200, say if you appropriate $500 million instead of $800 million. As written, 4002 would require us to do a proration. But as the bills are written and together right now, it would allow us to give $1,200 to each person, even if there were, if our estimate was wrong on the number of people.
Okay, excuse me, Mr. Chair. I mean, I appreciate the clarification. I mean, when I read one bill, I read it
right.
That's 1,200. When I read the other, it suggests that it may be 1,200, subject to appropriation and availability of funds. So you may be coming back in January for a supplemental because you find that Or does 4,003 just kind of give you open-ended access to state GF to pay the 1,200?
Through the chair to Senator Elton, as written right now, the bill would allow us to expend more than $800 million.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just looking at what the ramifications of what we're being asked to do, how that carries forward to next year. This gets us essentially through the winter of 08-09 first half. Let's assume that fuel costs remain the same. The administration announces energy programs. My assumption that in 12 months we will not be able to do things that long-term wise will impact the dynamics any different than they are this year. So, and then now we're back here in Juneau with the bad habit of special sessions next year in July, and why would it be unreasonable for Alaskans to say, well, nothing's changed, we need the $1,200? Help me, because I don't know what the administration programs are going to be. They're going to be announced in December, January, but I feel confident in saying it will not change the dynamics that are on the ground today. Help me out if I'm wrong.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Huggins, I don't know that you are wrong. I know that the bill that we have before you today is intended to be one time. It has a sunset date. We absolutely recognize the need to address, as all of us here in the room, the long-term cost of energy to Alaskans, and we're going to be working on those solutions. The one before you today is meant to be short term and one time.
And Mr. Chairman, just to follow up on that, given that scenario and that Alaskans come back to people sitting at this table that and others that might be representing the regions, and the legislature passes legislation to extend the $1,200, your intent is for it to be for 1 year. What's the administration going to do to keep it down to 1 year?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Huggins, you know, I certainly can't predict what the in a year from now, if we're in the same situation, what might happen there. I suspect that over the course of this next, what we're doing in this session, what we'll be doing in the interim before the regular session, hopefully we'll put some plans in place that all of us agree to that are going to help with this situation in the future. But I can't say today what the administration would do if the legislature chose to extend this in a year from now. I can't tell you that.
Yeah. And Mr. Chairman, my concern is very simple, that we are creating an expectation here, and that concerns me. Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you look at page 3, under D, you touched on it briefly, it had to do with the municipal airport consideration there. I guess one of the things that I was concerned about is that who are they going to be the big beneficiaries of this subsection, and are there any other entities that are out there that are not involved besides the airport, the municipal airports?
Do you have the shared taxes?
I do.
To the chair, Senator Olson, we don't share taxes with anyone besides municipal airports under this program, so there would be no other beneficiaries or losers from the loss of the airport revenue. The largest the largest amount to a municipality is to the Juneau, which is almost half of the total amount of the $150,000. And it then is spread through a number of other municipal airports to throughout the state.
Mr. Chairman, just a clarification. Does that mean you're sharing with more rural airports, more urban airports, or what's the general bias of the whole intent here?
To the Chair, Senator Olson, and as you know, Fairbanks and Anchorage are state-owned airports. As number the larger airports other than Juneau tend to be in the state, so this was sharing with municipally owned airports throughout the state, and there's quite a number of them, and we can get that shared tax report to you.
If you would, please. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm just kind of curious, if we look at this as a resource rebate and one avenue, or try to look it through a different lens that's been on the table here, some kind of an energy rebate, which I think is we're getting conflicting information sent to the public. Has there been a discussion by the administration of what dollar level a barrel of oil should be before the state steps in and tries to help? Or is, and also the trigger in and the trigger out?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of a discussion about a cap or setting some kind of a range where we would opt in or opt out. Mr. Ruaro may know, but I have not been involved in a discussion about a cap.
So we can conceivably face an issue like this at $80 a barrel or $90 or $130, or getting to Senator Huggins' earlier question of how do you turn this thing off once you turn it on, and we all understand the ramifications and the digestion a lot of us had at our Christmas and Thanksgiving dinners when the seniors had their longevity bonus turned off and we had to sit and have dinner with our parents. It seemed to be a subject that came up, at least in my family, every family dinner for at least 2 years running. And this program would go statewide. Do we have to hunker down and never leave Juneau, or will it be safe to go home if we turn this thing off?
We would welcome your stay in Juneau.
Mr. Chairman, I understand the concern about that. The governor's desire here is really to provide one-time, short-term relief for what we know is concerning all of us deeply. That's why we're here, and I know that in her discussions, she has said clearly that there are other ideas out there, and she's willing to consider them. But she really believes that there's something that we need to do for Alaskans, and I think we all believe that, and that's why we're here.
Okay. And with that, I think that was a good. You have last question.
Just a request,
sure.
Perhaps, Mr. Chair, and thanks for allowing me to make it. I want to reference the section on the aviation tax and the rebates to municipalities. Could you get back to the committee with how much revenue total is lost, not just to the municipalities, but to all of the airports? One of the concerns that I have the aviation fuel tax proceeds. I don't have a problem with general aviation having getting the benefit of a tax suspension, but I would be interested in knowing how much of those taxes come from commercial aviation, because I suspect that there is going to be no getting rid of fuel surcharges that commercial aviation is placing on, and I suspect that there is going to be no reflection in the fares if they don't have a fuel surcharge. And so I need to know how much of a benefit we're giving to the commercial industry and at what cost to the state.
To the Chair, Senator Elton, because we tax all our motor fuel taxes at the distributor level, finding that information is not something that we can get out of tax returns. It's not something that we have in our system as to who is the who is actually purchasing that fuel, but we will attempt to define that. The other thing that you should remember is that international flights, fuel purchased in Alaska is exempt from the tax already.
And Senator Thomas, you had a closing question for us?
Just one short comment, and that's regarding some of the conversation that's taken place. I see nothing that indicates that the price of oil is going to go down dramatically, and that will be the only thing that really has an impact on the majority of people's energy costs. So with that in mind, I think even though it's termed as a one-year short term, I think short term more in my mind is more of a 3 to 5 year program or something. So I'd encourage you to take a look at that as you make statements in the future, because I see nothing short of the price of oil going down that's going to have any impact on what's taking place in the state for the next at least 3 to 5 years. No bullet line, nothing's going to happen that's going to have any dramatic impact. So thank you.
And with that, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside for later work. We're going to post later today. I think what we'll do is we'll post a schedule for the Finance Committee. I've got to have a meeting with Senator Hoffman later today about the upcoming schedule. There's two bills that have been introduced in the House, 4005 and 4006. I should say in the other body. They will be introduced here. They'll be read across today at 4 o'clock on the floor of the Senate. My understanding is they'll be referred to this committee. And I just encourage the members of the committee along with their staff to go ahead and pick those bills up earlier than later and start to work on them. We may not have them on the table. They'll either be on the table tomorrow or they'll be on the table Monday, but there's no reason to wait to work on them. I think most of us are familiar with power cost equalization and LIHEAP, so we can gain some time as the clock is running on the special session, and I'm sure there's nobody in the legislature that would like to be here on the 8th of August, with the ending date being the 7th. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, in that respect, the meeting of our Energy Committee this afternoon is in question because of a response from the Canadians. It's not confirmed. As it may, we're looking at potentially delaying for a short period of time if we don't have confirmation, but a warning order that we may cancel the meeting this afternoon because the Canadians may not be able to make that. And if they can't, assuming they can to a later date, our next objective date is on Monday to do that.
And just for the folks that are home that are watching and curious on how the process works, a lot of work is not done at the committee level. It's done at the staff level and with throughout the building as we try to work out some of these details on these bills and build work on consensus and then bring things back to the table to continue to work on them and refine them and get them out. So the work will continue through the weekend. Quite frankly, I'm concerned with the amount of workload that we have dealing with the energy issues across the state, that by the 7th of August is not an allowable time frame to come up with anything other than a Band-Aid to get us through the winter and to make sure the homes, the residents of the state are heated through the winter with the high cost of oil. So we'll have some discussion dealing with that, I'm sure, is the paramount concern. And then if we could come up with a piece or of a longer-term solution, we'll take it. But it appears with discussions that I've had with other senators that the focal point over the next 2 years could very well be an energy policy for the state of Alaska in the long term and how we're going to break the state down in its component parts as far as the areas have different energy needs. So this work is complex and large dollar amounts. And with that, this meeting's adjourned.